government and the assessor's office kind of talked about this and talked about nobody in my family would be with me at all. I was like,
do you have brothers and sisters?
No, I was only child.
And, so how did you start singing? Did you do it in church? Or?
Well, yeah, I started singing in church, although my earliest memories were like when I was about 3 years old. My grandmother, she lived with us, and she used to, of course, be there at the house and babysit me all day, and we would watch American Bandstand on Sunday afternoon, and I just knew then that's what I want to do. And she would always have me dance, you know, while the show was on, and I would sing along. And so I've always known that's what I wanted to do, but I never got the chance until I was probably 7 years old when I was in the choir at the church, and I just was in choirs and sang since then.
And do you also play piano?
I tried. I taught myself to play, and then I took piano in college. I played clarinet from the sixth grade through college as well. But now I leave the instrument to people who really want to do that.
So
fight. And, like, I remember I loved Judy Garland when I was small. I love the way she held her microphone. I was just obsessed with that, and that's the way I hold my microphone now.
What is that?
I mean, it's just, it's nothing, you know, special, but just the way she held the mic and would hold the cord. She would sort of caress the cord and let it go. And that's, I just, you know, do that, not thinking, because I always practiced it that way.
Right.
You know, and that was just one of those quirks, I guess. Yeah, I write a lot of my own music.
Could you tell me about some of those original songs and what you write about?
I have three and a half CDs of original music, and the very first one I did was mostly like an R&B feel. We always do some reggae, because like I said, my fiance Bob, he's from Jamaica, so there's always some reggae in everything that we do. And so I've, you know, written a few reggae tunes, some blues. I have a blues sampler. I really haven't done that much blues, but because I do the show, The Lady and the Empress, I wrote this show about Bessie Smith, who's the Empress of the Blues. That's how I sort of got the label of being a blues singer. But I don't really do that much blues in my regular performance, but you know, I've written some blues tunes as well. I've written a lot of music. I told somebody the other day, I just started writing again a few days ago after a couple of years. I haven't written any songs in about 2 years, and then I just got in the mood the other day and I've just been writing. And so I brought my pad in here. Oh, I was waiting on you, and I thought in case I get an idea, I'll jot it down. Because my brain, I think as I get older, I'm finding my brain holds less and less. And I used to be able to really multitask well as far as, you know, I guess emotionally be completely present in this. I'm doing this right now, but let me stop for a second and go over here and do this. I could do that really well. And now I'm like, I have to do one thing at a time. And I think probably the last couple of years, actually since 2013, I've been organizing a jazz and blues festival, and that like takes all of my brain, and I think that really had me wrapped up, you know, the last couple of years, and I'm trying to get back to me now. I've been so concerned about the festival and finding money for it and finding the artists and things. In other words, paying other people to pay me. So now I have to really get back to, you know, booking my own stuff and getting back out there, because I took care of my mother for about 3 years before she passed away, and she stayed here with me. So that was like a 24/7 thing because she was bedridden. And I wasn't able to perform as much as I wanted to. And so I was basically stuck here. And then right before she died, my car broke down. I haven't been able to get another car, so I'm literally stuck here a lot of times. And so now, because of finances and everything, I have to get back out there. And so that in itself sort of has gotten my creative juices flowing again as far as my own stuff. So I think in one way is bad, but then in another way it's kind of getting me off my butt, you know. And usually it's words. It just depends. I mean, anything can trigger something for me. A lot of times I used to really get the melody a lot. My Bob, my keyboard player, he's the one I write with. So when I get melodies and things like that, I tell him so I can hear it. And then, I mean, he said, this is not going to work. That's not going to work. You know, so then, you know, I figured I need to get the whole song first before I take it to him. So, but now it's mostly words are coming first and concepts and ideas, because I'm realizing my head is in a completely different place than it was when pictures of, you know, rural political views, but, like, I've told a lot of people, I try to learn from everything that I do, and even putting this festival together turned out to be so political. It went from, let's bring some good jazz and blues music into Southern West Virginia, and it turned out to be so political, you know? Everybody's trying to make more of it than the original intent. And I think even that, you know, is like an underlying thing that I have of still being kind of upset, you know, about trying to do that even here. So it's more of a, I guess, localized political protest that's going on in my head. Well, no, when we started out in the first festival was in 2013, we started out with 7 people that said, yeah, we want to do this. And so when we did it, I mean, it was great. The festival turned out great. Of course, we didn't make any money, but we should. When we started, we weren't trying to make money. We knew we weren't going to make money for 3 or 4 years, probably. Everybody understood that. Until it was over with, and we were so deep in debt, you know, so everybody's coming out of their pocket to cover this, which, you know, I told everybody at the beginning, I don't have money. I don't have any money. This is all going to have to be sponsorships and advertising. And so then once it was over with, and the sort of the afterglow of how great it went away, now everybody's mad because they had to spend money. So now it's down to me and one person put this together the last 3 years. And so that's not an issue about, you know, who's going to come. It's just the pressure of trying to get the money to cover it. And so, but the politics of it, you know, came from the first year we did it. We did it actually right outside Hinton in, we called it Sandstone Drift. And it's about 15 minutes from here. And it was right over the Summers County line. So then, you know, it's over with, and everybody was saying, this is great and everything. And I hear rumblings here in Bethel, well, why couldn't it have been in Bethel? Why didn't you do it in Bethel? Well, because nobody here wanted to even talk to me when I was asking, could we use this spot or that spot, or, you know, can Bethel help? You know, so we were trying to diss Bethel and Raleigh County by not doing it here. So, okay, we moved it into Bethel, and we still can't get the support that we need, so that's what still has me kind of just upset. It's called the Century Jazz and Blues Festival. We sort of grew out of the fact that I host a radio show called Century Jazz and Blues every Sunday evening, and I've been doing that for 6 years. And so after a couple of years or so, I thought, well, maybe we should try a festival because we're building this audience here. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. I mean, I didn't go looking for that job of doing this radio show. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how I even got in that position. But the thing is, I mean, jazz and blues is not exactly mainstream here, you know, in Raleigh County. So Tamarack was a sponsor of my radio show when we first started, and they would let me do a live show there at Tamarack for every 3 or 4 months. And so the audience grew from that because we were consistently doing that. And so I thought a festival would be something to try. And now the festival is growing slowly. And it's just, I mean, it's been a great experience, you know, with the artists and everything. But like I was saying before, like on that kind of thing. You know, when they want something different, then they'll call me. You know, or they, if they're having a, because, you know, I'm labeled as a jazz singer, too. Which I really don't like singing jazz that much. You know, it's not my thing, but I sing it if you're paying me to do it. But, yeah, I feel for the odd man out here. But at the same time, it's like when people want to know about musicians, they call me because they think I know everybody for some reason. I mean, even country people or whatever, when they want to know about them, or do I know of any new places to play and things like that. I'm supposed to know, and here I'm looking for places to play. So it's kind of weird. Yeah, I think so. Statewide, I don't feel like I'm connected to it. I don't feel like I'm part of it. And even talking to other musicians, I think the musicians who were like at their peak probably in the late 60s and the 70s, those people have history. They have the stories and things. People who are performing now, they have, they're here and they're just scattered and they're just doing their thing. But I don't think any of them even really feel part of something. Mm-hmm. But I was telling you about Rabbit Young. When he was performing, all those people knew each other. I mean, from around the state, they mm-hmm. all knew, they played jazz, they knew each other. You know, and so that's, I think, a big difference between then and now. Everybody's just kind of on their own and doing their own thing, but they're not connected in any way. There's no kind of cohesive force. There's no, well, there is a musical union, but there's nothing that brings everybody together. I think there's a lot more venues then, but and this is just sort of the path that I'm on with this, in talking to Rabbit. I mean, there were 33 black-owned clubs in Charleston, and from the mid-40s to the mid-60s, and he owned the first one that was licensed. And so there was always some place to play. When I was a teenager and couldn't get into the club, there were all kinds of clubs that people were going to, and I said, you know, I can't go here, this group or that group, but there were so many places to play. And there are fewer places to play, but the places that are hiring are paying the same money that they were paying in the 60s and 70s. Personal experience, I think a lot of it is that the people who own this club, music is not the focus. It's to, you know, the bar is usually the focus, or if it's a restaurant, then the food is usually the focus. So there's not very many places that even focus on music being a draw. And so music always, in any situation, is the last thing people think about. I mean, you know, even if they're getting ready to have kind of a family reunion or some kind of event or whatever, the last thing, oh, we need some music, you know. Let's get a DJ or let's get a live performer, but it can't cost more than $100. Yeah. So it's always the last thing that people just, they don't stop to think about what would your thing, whatever venue or your party or whatever, what would it be like if there was no music? Because the venues are not there that are willing to feature that kind of music. Here in West Virginia, and I've noticed, and I feel like I can say it because I was born and raised here. I've been a lot of other places, but West Virginia is sort of spoon-fed by the masses of whatever they feel like is, you know, these clubs. If they have a big night with a country group, and they feel like they need to do country every weekend, and so we just fill this place up.
Yeah.
And so if everybody feels that way, then you have everybody's opening a country bar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they're going to hire.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to take a chance on something else that might not keep those people coming in. And I think that's, you know, a lot of it, too. I mean, when you get to a city like Morgantown, Charleston, and Huntington, of course, then you have enough variety of venues that you can have different styles of music, but still, it's like, you know, are those venues really promoting whatever the music is, because they're not really into the music, they just want to feel the bar at. So I think there's a lot of different things that go along with making it successful, and it has to be, I was just reading, an article about the 35th Star over in Third County, where used to be Tim Fells and Whitewater Rafting Bar, and the guy saying, you know, he and his partner, they just took this place over a few months ago. They're focused on the music. They want to be a music venue, and they have all these acts coming through them. And they're, okay, well, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, but give it a few more months, and I bet you won't be focused on the music because you got to pay the electric bill.
Yeah.
And that touring band that you got in there didn't draw because nobody heard of it.
Yeah, sometimes I think with that stuff, especially building a local music community or make it viable for musicians, it's a little forgotten because they want to have the touring band.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you had any mentors over the course of your career?
And I was growing up, and they were mostly in the gospel field, like Bishop T.D. Jakes. I've known him. He introduced me to my first husband, and I was in his choir for years, and he was a great singer and piano player. And he's in Ethel Cathy Austin, and lots of gospel people that I always looked up to. You know, here in the area, but as far as the music that I really wanted to do, people like Chaka Khan and Roberta Flack and Natalie Cole, those were the people that I wanted to be on.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't really anybody local that I really saw as a mentor.
Yeah.
So we got to go to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration and everything. And blah, blah, blah. Yeah, there's lots of fun.
Did they play it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we played at one of the, and there was like 33 inaugural balls, and we played at one of them. And, yeah, the first inaugural. And that was really cool, you know, everything that happened from that. So I got a big boost. My reputation got a big boost from that. People all over West Virginia wanted me to come and perform for free. Because, of course, that must have been a big payday to go to Washington. So they assumed, you know, I didn't need any money, so I wanted to come and sing that song. I was singing that song for a whole year. But anyway, then the next year, a man who lives in Hyco, his name was Rick McClung. He was an old-time radio guy. He had done a radio show in Charleston back in the 60s. And he had also worked for the radio station here, Southern Communications, and he was in 7. He had a friend in Chicago. He had lived in Chicago and worked on the air there and Chess Records and everything. And so he played organ. And he was a big jazz and blues lover, and he wanted somebody to write him some blues tunes. And he was talking to some friend in Chicago who happened to know that I won this contest. And he told him, there's a woman somewhere there in West Virginia that you should get in contact with, and maybe she can help you. So he calls the radio station up there. This time I had no connection with the radio station at all, and asked them if they knew how to get in touch with me, and somebody said, yeah. And so he connected with me and told me who he was and would I collaborate with him on some music. And I was like, yeah, sure. You know, so then he introduces me to the guy at the radio station, and then I write him a couple of tunes, and we record them. And then he says, well, Shane said he would like us to do a jazz and blues radio show. And so he was actually my co-host when we first started. Now, he was older in his 60s, and he was a really hypochondriac, too. So we started the show in February, and of course the roads were bad sometimes and he didn't come, so I sort of had to teach myself the soundboard and all that at the station, and then he just stopped coming. So from then on I had the show all by myself until now, so that's how that came about. That's a roundabout way of telling you.
And so where does it broadcast?
It's in this area, and you can pick it up in Charleston. It's 94.1 FM, but it does stream online, 94.com, so you can listen on the internet, and I've got a lot of people in the country that listen to the show, so that's kind of cool.
And it's jazz and blues from all over?
All over. Yeah, not very often, but my granddaughter, my step-granddaughter, she was listening last Sunday, and these kids, and so her, especially the girl group that she has, they're called teens, you know, I guess I sort of feel a special connection with them. I use them as much as possible, you know, in different things, shows that I do, and they listen to, you know, they came to open a festival the last couple of years, and, yeah, I just see a lot of potential. Yeah, Melissa, she was actually met Lisa's protege right before he died. She was really learning a lot from him the last couple of years. Well, she played guitar, but he was teaching her blues. Basically, she's a great blues singer. So, yeah, she would be somebody that you could talk to. Rabbit Jones, of course. Ethel Cathy, if you can run her down. there's also in the Charleston area, people like Martha Petty, who's a sax player, and he wasn't. You're thinking about Dugan Carter. Yeah, he's another one. Both of his parents were well-known musicians, jazz musicians.
Okay.
Yeah. Dugan and Bob Thompson, of course. Bob Thompson knew a lot of the people that were, he was sort of like one of Rabbit Jones had like a following of young musicians that, you know, would go all over town with these after parties and sitting in clubs, you know, after these shows. He would tell me about, you know, Count Basie and Lionel Hampton and these people coming to play in the municipal auditorium. And this was before segregation was over. And so they would play for the white audiences at the municipal, and then they would leave there and go to all these clubs around town, just bark out all night till like 7 o'clock in the morning. And people like Bob Thompson and Vince Lewis, the guy that was here a couple of weeks ago, he would take them around to all these places, you know, so they could sit in with these people, you know. So yeah. Depends on what it is that you're looking for specifically, or I don't see myself as somebody to go in the history books. Yeah, but
well, what
I'll
would
tell
be
you whatever you want.
What would be your sort of I don't know, your ideal for what happens in your music and career?
I just want to keep doing what I'm doing, but on a larger scale and getting paid more money. Which, you know, I'm feeling right now like I do need to go and leave here at least for a while. I mean, I like West Virginia. I spent my first 18 years of life trying to get out of West Virginia. You know? But then I kept coming back, you know. And but it's not an ideal place for somebody that likes to perform, or who has to perform, you really need to go somewhere else. And even though I'm getting older now, I mean, I feel like everybody's got an audience somewhere. You know, but and I need to go and find more audience, because it's not here. You know?
I'll pay you the ticket.